The School Nature Area Project.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to a special edition of Midday. I'm Gary Eichen, and today we're broadcasting live from the DFL Party's state convention here at the Mayo Civic Center in Rochester. The convention officially got underway about 2 hours ago. Today, the delegates will be spending their time on party business. Tomorrow, though, they get down to the real business of this convention, trying to decide which of six candidates they will endorse for the U.S. Senate seat currently held by Republican Rod Grams. We will begin our live coverage of that debate tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, so I sure hope you'll be able to tune in. Today, here on Midday, we're getting ready for the big day. Now, last hour, we met all the candidates. This hour, we're going to focus on how this convention will likely play out, how the process works, and how what happens here will affect those of you who aren't here. We've been joined by Minnesota Public Radio's political analysts Sarah Stace and Tom Horner, and we invite you to join our conversation. If you have a question or comment about the convention, give us a call, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free, and that number is 1-800-242-2828. 651-227-6000, 1-800-242-2828. Great opportunity to get your oar in the water here as we begin our coverage of the DFL State Convention from Rochester. Sarah, Tom, thanks for coming by today.
Thank you. Always fun to be at conventions.
Now, Sarah, as the DFLer, you have home court advantage, so let me start with you. This should be absolute heaven for these state convention delegates, don't you think?
It is absolute heaven. There are many candidates. They are very present. They all have... some slightly stronger than others, but all of them working very, very hard, all trying to surge here in the last day before the endorsement. They all have signs throughout the convention and many, many T-shirts, hats, and buttons, so it absolutely is heaven.
Well, and I would think that, you know, a lot of times delegates, they come to have a good time, but they're mostly there just to... ratify decisions that have already been made. But here, they're the decision makers.
Absolutely. This is one of the most fluid conventions, maybe the most fluid convention in decades here in Minnesota. Usually, at this point in the campaign season, we're down to two, maybe three at the most, candidates. And it's only a matter of fighting it out, really, between two big blocks. This time, the sky's the limit, really. We think that there are about 30% undecided delegates. Some people think it may be as high as 40 or 45%. And the other thing that's very interesting that I've been noticing this time is that many of the delegates are saying, well, my candidate is so-and-so, but my second choice is this other person. So they're identifying themselves with two candidates instead of one, waiting to see who achieves momentum on the first or second ballot and then being very willing to switch. I do think that this is a convention that is very focused on endorsing a candidate. I think the chances, despite the fact that there are so many candidates, I think the likelihood that there will be no endorsement is not very high. People are here to endorse, and they've thought through their strategies for second and third ballots.
Okay, half full or half empty? This is my next question here. We have a lot of candidates. Does that mean that we have a lot of good candidates or a lot of okey-doke candidates?
Well, it's the Republican. I think that it's a field unlike what has been presented to particularly DFL conventions in the past. What distinguishes this field of candidates is not whether they're good or bad candidates. I mean, I think like any field of this many candidates, some are better than others. I think there are among some of these candidates, probably not the ones who will get the endorsement, some very compelling candidates who would run a very strong race against Senator Grams. But I think what distinguishes this field of candidates is that while some of them have had strong and long ties to the party, I mean, you have Mark Dayton, who's been around for 20-plus years, Jerry Janicich serving in the legislature around for a long time, certainly others who have paid their dues, Steve Kelly and others. But you don't have the strong, deep-seated historical loyalties of these delegates to candidates. You don't have a Humphrey. You don't have a Freeman. You don't have a Mondale. And I think that makes it both a very different field of candidates and a very different kind of convention. It's not only that the delegates are important this year because they want to endorse and they want to endorse a winner, but I think this, in a lot of ways, could be a watershed convention for the DFL. Can they endorse a winner? Can they endorse somebody who doesn't just do well in the general election but gets through the primary election, which hasn't often been the case for the DFL candidates?
Sir? You know, I would agree this is a pretty serious convention for the DFL. The DFL has not had a strong record in the last few campaigns of endorsing winning candidates, and so, in fact, Tom's right. We don't have a Humphrey, we don't have a Mondale, we don't have a Freeman as a candidate in this race. The delegates this time are trying something very, very different, and that is taking a broad look at a number of candidates who have not run before for statewide office, who don't have statewide name recognition, and trying to make a decision as to whether one of them will be able to mount a formidable campaign against Grahams. It's important for the DFL to nominate somebody strong who can come through a primary and win that primary this time, having been so embarrassed in the last campaign. And I think the delegates are very focused on making sure that that happens. And that's why you see so many of them undecided and waiting to see who among the candidates gives the best speech, has the strongest, most compelling presence, and also can come in strong on the first ballot.
Political analyst Sarah Stace and Tom Horner are our guests this hour. And again, if you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000, outside the Twin Cities, 1-800-242-2828. 651-227-6000, 1-800-242-2828. Live coverage of the DFL State Convention here on our midday program today. Really, the coverage is going to pick up substantially tomorrow. Tomorrow's the big day when they actually will start voting, try to decide who to endorse, and we'll be on the air. But today is a great opportunity to kind of set the scene, and love to get a call from you. Al's on the line from Rochester. Good afternoon, Al.
Yes, Gary, I'm delighted to speak with you. I've been listening to your program for the last 2 hours, and I've been a resident of Rochester for 40 years. Prior to coming here, I spent 20 years on the musical stage in Hollywood, and in 1948, I was on the team that helped design the defeat of Dewey down in Missouri. I was on Harry Truman's team. Wow. So I've followed politics in your state here now for 40 years, and last night as I left the public library, I walked over about 9 o'clock to the Civic Center, and the first thing I saw was the vast glass area had been covered with signs of Cerisi, the candidate. And it impressed me as if he was trying to overkill, you know. I think, and as you get inside the Civic Center arena there, you see Cerisi everywhere. Now, I'm not putting the man down, but if I was on his team advising him, I would have advised him to at least have half as what he has there, because in my opinion, Cerisi's problem is that his perception of being wealthy and having all this money and having obtained a large tobacco payoff, that he should present himself as more among the other people who don't have all this money and can engage in all this ostentatiousness.
Okay.
And I think he'd be advised to slow down and try to become more of a regular guy than a guy who can show off in such a fashion.
Okay, thanks, Al. Appreciate the call.
You know, I think that's a very good point that Al's making. Cerisi's strength is also his weakness. He is a very wealthy person, and he does have the ability to fund his campaign to a certain extent and also to raise a lot of money. But if you'll look at his ads, you'll see that he's trying very hard to sandpaper a little bit of that off of himself and to come across as much more of your kind of humble origins, guy next door, guy down the street kind of person, because it's true also that self-funded wealthy candidates have not had a great track record in the last number of years running across the country.
But the problem is that if you walk like a duck, if you quack like a duck, you are a duck. I mean, it's hard to reinvent yourself in a campaign. And Mike Cerisi is a wealthy trial attorney who made a ton of money from litigation and no getting around that. Mike Cerisi is a candidate who has determined that he will spend what it takes to win this election. He already has put more of his own money into this campaign than any candidate has raised, and there have been some pretty impressive fundraising totals. Rebecca Yonish has raised over $400,000. Cerisi has already dumped over $600,000 by his own reckoning into this campaign, and I think that's going to be an issue that he can't run away from, and no amount of dumbing down or becoming more folksy in ads is going to remove that as a very significant issue for Mike Cerisi.
It's interesting that Mark Dayton is saying that he is not going to put his own money into his campaign this time, having learned a lesson about self-funded campaigns last time himself.
Mm-hmm. Now, during the profiles that we broadcast the first hour, Mike Cerisi addressed this issue to some degree, saying, you know, he's puzzled. We keep hearing about the importance of people getting a start in life, working their way up, making something of themselves, and how critical that is, especially for Democrats, he said. But then when you do that, then you're hammered for it.
No, but Gary, I think people see a difference between a self-made person who made money by making something, by manufacturing, by starting a business, by employing people, by creating something. I think what Mike Cerisi's challenge is going to be is that he has made a lot of money from fees, from litigation, from going after companies. And whether or not you agree with the litigation, and, you know, as I've said in the past, I work with Blue Cross, I support the tobacco litigation, and it would not have been won without Mike Cerisi, but it is still going to be a very significant issue that he's going to have to face in this campaign, and I think it will be one difficult issue for him to get over.
Well, I think what you're hearing from Tom right now is what you would expect to hear should Cerisi get the endorsement or should he win the primary if he is in a battle against the Republican candidate. That is exactly the kind of charge that the Republicans will level against Cerisi. There's another way to look at it, however, and that is that Mike Cerisi did not make his lawyer money off of defending large polluting industries. He made his money defending people who, protecting the rights of people who had been wronged by companies like large tobacco companies and others. So, yes, it's true, he's a trial attorney, but he's not a trial attorney who's been sticking up for the interests of the wealthy and the powerful. He's a trial attorney who's been sticking up for people who otherwise might not have had a voice. And so, as I say, his strength is also, or his weakness is also his strength.
We're broadcasting live from the DFL State Convention underway here in Rochester at the Civic Center, Mayo Civic Center. If you'd like to join our conversation with Tom Horner and Sarah Stace, give us a call, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Great opportunity to learn a little bit more about how this convention, one of the more interesting ones we've had a chance to cover in a long, long time, or could be anyway, we'll see. Good opportunity to find out a little bit more about how this might all play out. Fred, go ahead, please.
I had a question as to what's happening with the Ole Saviors campaign. During the debates you broadcasted earlier this week, he was railing against everyone about being ignored and not being included. And I didn't hear anything about him in the first hour of the program, and I'm just afraid that if he's ignored, he's just going to get more and more ammunition and really probably get more attention than he deserves at this point.
Okay, well, Mr. Savior does have a sign up. We spotted one sign for him. I don't know if Dick Franson, the other perennial candidate, has a sign up. Both had indicated they were going to try to make it to the convention, and they both say they're going to run in the primary. It's, I think, fair to say that they will not be endorsed at this convention, and I think it's fair to say they're not going to win the primary either. But one of the beauties, of course, of the political system, which people tend to forget, is that anybody can run.
And particularly in Minnesota's system. I mean, it is one of the strengths of a caucus system is that you can get involved, and very few numbers of people getting involved can make a huge difference. I think the other thing that has certainly changed the dynamics, of course, is Jesse Ventura, not just because he was elected, but I think the focus he brought to the importance of debates, and debates as a forum, and debates as a way of distinguishing yourself. But the other side of the coin is that you already have a crowded field of credible candidates. Is it a self-fulfilling prophecy? Are Ole Savior and Franson not credible candidates because they don't get the show, or don't they get the show because they're not credible candidates? Still, how do you put 7, 8, 9 candidates on a stage in a debate or in an hour-long program of profiles and have enough time to learn anything about any one of them? I mean, at some point there has to be a screening process where somebody makes decisions about who ought to be presented to the public, I suppose.
I should ask you, folks, the candidates, for the most part, the ones who do have some kind of a chance here to get an endorsement, all seem pretty much in agreement on the issues. There's a little tweaking here, a little tweaking there, but largely seem to be in agreement. So what's the distinguishing factors? If you're one of these delegates, are you looking at personality?
Well,
are you
yes.
looking at money? Are you looking at the quote electability, whatever that is?
Certainly you're looking at all of those things. Issues are very, very important, and obviously that's the first screen that people use to evaluate a candidate, decide whether or not to support that person. But on the other hand, there are other more less obvious perhaps factors such as personality, charisma, the ability to deliver a compelling speech, the ability to show oneself as a leader, leadership skills that people will follow, so that not only can this person be elected senator, but can provide effective leadership once in the Senate. And those are a little bit more difficult to get your arms around, but they're obviously very, very important criteria. And the candidates are now all trying to distinguish themselves based on these much more elusive kinds of criteria. We call it electability. It means something different to everybody, but basically it is, are these candidates compelling people that others will follow?
And I think also, while it's true that if you look across the broad spectrum of issues, the candidates would agree probably on 80-90% of those issues, I think where you do find significant differences, though, is in their issues of emphasis, both in choosing the issue that they choose to emphasize and then in their positions on those issues. The most notable ones certainly are Steve Miles in health care has made that not only the centerpiece of his campaign, but almost his entire campaign. Health care reform, universal health care, getting government more involved in health care. And Steve Kelly, who has made an issue out of technology and creating a technological future for Minnesota and connecting people to technology, where again he has made that not just the centerpiece of his campaign, but really the essence of his campaign. And I think in those kinds of issues, the candidates, particularly those maybe who are trying to break through a little bit, really hope that by focusing on an issue, they can connect with delegates, and from there they can connect with voters.
I think sometimes it's easier for people who don't follow the process very closely when they're trying to form a mental image of who these various people are, to compare them to somebody who they may be familiar with. And I'm wondering, now, do all of these candidates fit into the Paul Wellstone mold, or the Bill Clinton mold? Who should we compare the candidates to?
I think Jerry Janusich and Steve Miles and, to an extent, David Lillehog would all think of themselves as Paul Wellstone type candidates. All of them have close ties to Wellstone, have been involved with his campaigns, and in fact many of the Wellstone activists are deeply involved in the campaigns of all three of these candidates. They see all three of the candidates as being closely aligned with Paul on the issues, and also are attempting to run campaigns that are very much like Paul Wellstone's campaign, which was a grassroots campaign. Cerisi is a different kind of candidate, not completely different than Paul Wellstone on the issues. In fact, again, fairly similar to Paul on the issues, but representing a very different kind of constituency. I'm not seeing any of there really aren't any true centrists in this campaign, within this particular convention. However, maybe Steve Kelly, perhaps a little bit farther to the right. Some people might think Cerise is a little farther to the right. I don't know if that's true or not. I think that's debatable. But generally speaking, the candidates tend to be to the left of center, not far extreme left, but somewhat to the left of center, and representative of the voters in the DFL primary.
I think where these candidates would like to be, who they'd like to be identified with, I think Steve Kelly very much would like to be identified as a more congenial Al Gore, a vision for the future, somebody who is looking to technology to be the answer. I think Janicich would like to model himself after Rudy Perpich, a populist, somebody who comes from the range but cares about people, can go into coffee shops and connect with people. I think Cerise would like to be seen as a middle-of-the-road business candidate, somebody who on social issues is going to be liberal but isn't going to scare off the business community. I think Janicich very much would like to be a middle-of-the-road candidate, but certainly playing up the difference of her gender and getting that message out. Whereas I think Miles and Lillehog would like to be seen more as a Paul Wellstone around their issues. Very committed, very liberal, and very willing to see government play a much more significant role, not just in health care, Steve Miles' issues, but in a broad range of issues.
Let's get to one more caller here before we break for news. Paul, go ahead, please.
Yeah, so I was just calling on this Cerise thing, and I think it is going to be a negative impact, the amount of money, because the reason he made as much money as he did was the jury's desire to really punish the tobacco companies because of their deep pockets. Had this been another type of case and they were awarded $100 million, then he would have made $25 million. So it really doesn't go to, you know, that he, I mean, he did a good job, but again, it was a jury's desire to really punish the tobacco companies. So I think it's going to be sticking people's minds.
And that is one way to look at it, and I think it will stick in some people's minds. Other people, however, will not see it as the jury's intention to punish tobacco companies for having deep pockets, but the jury's intention to punish tobacco companies because they sold products which they knew were damaging to the health and lives of people who consumed them. So there are a number of people who will rally around somebody like Cerise and who will say, good for him, willing to take on big tobacco, although I certainly hear your point. It's a valid one.
But I think the problem Cerise will have is not that he can't get over that issue. I think he has enough money to explain away that issue. I think his challenge will be much the same challenge that Mark Dayton faced in one of his first forays into state politics in 1982 when he ran for the Senate against Dave Durenberger. And the issue Dayton had at that time is that he wasn't experienced enough to be in the Senate. He didn't have the credentials to be in the Senate. What he did have was money, and he could run advertising. And as long as Mark Dayton was on TV saying, I'm experienced enough, I'm credentialed enough, that was a non-issue. But as soon as he pulled those ads off, people didn't believe he was experienced. And the problem was that Mark Dayton could never move the agenda from, am I experienced enough, to why should you elect me? Why should you defeat Dave Durenberger? And I think that's Cerise's problem. Yes, he can set an agenda that says, my money isn't the issue, I did beat up tobacco and they deserve to be beat up, but that's not enough to win an election. That's just enough to get over that hurdle. How do you move the agenda to take it to Senator Graham's? And I think that's going to be his challenge.
We're broadcasting live today from the DFL State Convention, underway here at the Rochester Civic Center, the Mayo Civic Center in downtown Rochester. Our guests this hour, political analyst Sarah Stace, the Democrat, Tom Horner, the Republican, and taking a look at how this convention might play out, who the candidates are, the broader political implications of what's happening here. And, of course, the big thing that's going to happen here tomorrow is that delegates to this convention will actually have a big decision to make. Unlike so many conventions where everything's kind of cut and dried, the delegates here will actually decide who it is they're going to support for the U.S. Senate, and I don't think anybody is claiming to know how that's going to turn out. Well, we'll get back to some more callers' questions, and hopefully your question. Give us a call here, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000, or outside the Twin Cities, 1-800-242-2828. More callers coming up in just a couple of minutes, but right now let's catch up on news headlines. Here's Greta Cunningham. Greta?
Thanks, Gary, and good afternoon. Witnesses say the driver was yelling, "I can't stop," when his car plowed into a crowded playground at a Chicago elementary school this morning. Police say 11 people were injured in the crash. They include 7 adults and 4 children. Police say the 22-year-old driver is being questioned by investigators. They say early indications are that the crash was an accident. Officials say a crisis intervention team is on the scene to offer counseling to students, parents, and staff. Hundreds of thousands of Cuban women flooded Havana's main coastal highway today protesting Ilian Gonzalez's delayed return. Cuban leader Fidel Castro called them out for the largest mobilization in his six-month campaign to bring the boy home. A federal appeals court yesterday backed up a decision by immigration officials to deny an asylum hearing for the boy. The court gave Ilian's Miami relatives 14 days to appeal. An attorney for the relative says that the family hasn't yet decided whether to take their fight to the U.S. Supreme Court. The nation's tobacco companies are in federal court asking that a government lawsuit be dismissed. Big Tobacco argues the suit has no basis in law. The government says tobacco companies are a continuing public health threat. The suit seeks reimbursement for treatment of tobacco-related illnesses. In regional news, Minnesota's Democratic DFL Senator Paul Wellstone is not revealing who he'll back in tomorrow's endorsement vote at the DFL State Convention. Wellstone has a vote as a member of the Minnesota Congressional Delegation. For the first time, Minnesota's Democratic state legislators and members of Congress will all serve as delegates to this year's convention in a move intended to boost party participation. About 3,600 people are expected to attend the statewide DFL convention. There is no clear frontrunner in the DFL Senate endorsement. The forecast for Minnesota today calls for partly cloudy skies in the north with partly sunny skies in the south. High temperatures today mainly in the 60s. Tonight, clear skies in the east with some clouds in the west, lows ranging from 40 to 50 degrees. At this hour, Duluth reports some light rain and 52 degrees. Skies are cloudy in St. Cloud and 60. Rochester reports cloudy skies and 61. And in the Twin Cities, partly cloudy skies, a temperature of 60. That's a check on the latest news.
All right, thank you, Greta. 27 minutes before 1 o'clock. This is Midday coming to you live today. Special edition from the Rochester Mayo Civic Center, where the DFL State Convention is underway. Party business being conducted right now. Tomorrow, the big day for delegates here at the convention, when they will decide who they're going to support for the U.S. Senate seat currently held by Republican Rod Grams. Mike Erlinson, who is state party chair, has joined us here at our broadcast location. Good afternoon, Mr. Erlinson.
Good afternoon, Gary. Good to be with you.
Things seem mellow. No arms are being broken that we can see in public. Is that all happening behind the stage?
Well, there's no question that the candidates are out there doing as much human lobbying as possible. I don't think they're breaking any arms, but they're working at it real hard. We actually have candidates that are all committed to running against Rod Grams as the real target versus each other. And while they're all trying to make the case to the delegates that they're the best person to represent the DFL party as the endorsed candidate, at the same time, if you look around the room, our listeners can't see this, but the signs are all put up orderly. The candidates got together and divided up the wall spaces so it would be less of a war mentality, because they realize that the battle they're trying to win and the war they're trying to win is to beat Rod Grams on November 7th, not to beat up on each other. And so I'm pretty optimistic that we will leave the convention Sunday afternoon, united with the single biggest goal of beating Rod Grams. We're going to have a couple candidates in the primary, that's likely, but as long as our primary candidates do the same thing that all the candidates have done seeking the endorsement, which is stay focused on winning on November 7th, and stay focused on Rod Grams as the target versus each other, I think we'll be well-served as DFLers all summer and into the fall.
Whoever wins the endorsement, what will they get? What is that worth to them? What are you folks going to provide a candidate who gets the endorsement?
Well, that's always the million-dollar question, so to speak, no pun intended. I kind of look at it this way. You know, the endorsement is kind of like the DFL party's a race car. And what we do tomorrow on Saturday is we pick a driver for this race car. And he or she, when they get behind this wheel, still has to be able to help the party put the fuel in the gas tank. And there's a couple different types of fuel. There's the type of fuel which is the ability to mobilize people, organize the grassroots. And then there's the other kind of fuel that's all too important in politics today, which is just the money. You know, the Republican Party and Rod Grams has promised us that they're going to spend $10 million, if necessary, in Minnesota. And so we're going to have to do our best to compete in almost an unbelievable amount of money, I think, will be spent in politics, and not only in Minnesota this year, but across the country, if you look at the campaigns of the folks running for president. And so, you know, when we pick our endorsed candidate, the party has to make sure that we're helping that candidate put the fuel in the tank. But I think what the delegates are looking for when they make that evaluation tomorrow and listen to those speeches and look at the resumes and look at what they bring to the table is who can best do that, who has the ability to organize and get the people there to put the fuel in the tank, and who has the ability to raise the money.
Are you going to go all out, though, to try to defeat the unendorsed candidates, the other people in the primary?
Well, we're certainly going to do everything in our power as a party to support our endorsed candidates. We won't, what the party can't do, and I don't think it really ever has to, is do something that hurts our chances on November 7th. The reality is the political party and DFLers all across the state look at November 7th first and work their way backwards. But if you're a candidate or a campaign, you look at the today and you move forward. Because you have to win the prize of the endorsement and potentially the prize of the primary and then ultimately the general election, where as a DFL party itself, we have to be focused first and foremost on making sure we get rid of Rod Grams on November 7th, and that it's a DFLer that replaces him, not an independent or a Constitution Party or somebody else. But staying together and staying focused throughout the summer and supporting our endorsed candidate, I think, will be good for the party. I ultimately think that gets our candidate through the primary. If for some reason it doesn't, at least we're ready to make sure that on September 13th, we're moving together as a unified block on our way to November 7th.
All right, I'll ask you the question everybody asks everybody else here. What the heck? What's your best guess? How many ballots will it take tomorrow to make this decision?
I think I'll bet on 8 ballots, around 8 or 9 o'clock at night. And if I'm wrong, I'll be way off, and it'll be 2 or 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And if I'm right, I think we will be well on our way towards a positive and excited process, and DFLers ready to mobilize and really hit the campaign trail full speed ahead on June 3rd or 4th.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Gary. Good to be with you.
DFL State Party Chair Mike Erlandson joining us live here at the DFL State Convention in Rochester. Sarah Stace, Tom Horner are with us, sharing their expertise on how this convention may play out. Again, tomorrow, our live coverage will begin at 9 o'clock when the convention convenes, and we'll be broadcasting tomorrow the nominating speeches for the candidates. We'll hear from the candidates themselves, and then we'll keep you updated throughout the day on the as the balloting proceeds. As Mr. Erlandson indicated, well, it could be a fairly quick process, or, of course, it could go on and on and on. And
I think we'll have a pretty good sense on the first ballot as to whether it's going to go on and on and on and on. It will depend quite a lot on the size of the margin between the top vote getter and the second vote getter. So, for example, if the top vote getter comes in, you know, well over 30%, for example, that will say to us, and there's a big margin between that person and the second person, that will say to us that probably those on the bottom will begin to switch their votes right away and they will go to the candidate with the most momentum. If there's a small margin between the first and the second vote getter, then we're in for a much longer day. Another thing to watch will be the size of Cerisi's margin early on. He is has been working the delegates very, very hard, but he has said he's not going to abide by the endorsement and will definitely run in the primary nonetheless. Some people think that he might have some momentum. So if he comes in you know, well above the single digits, say he comes in to 15 to 20%, then that would signify, you know, potentially another shift or movement, especially among the 30%, 30 to 40% of undecided. So we'll know a lot on the first ballot.
I would add two other benchmarks. I think Sarah is absolutely right. But in terms of looking at two other things, One is where Janicek is on the first ballot, not just at the top, but can he get over 30%? And I think that's part of the expectations game. I think most people are expecting that he's going to come in the high 20s. If he can beat those expectations, then I think that's going to add significant momentum. And I think they're presuming Miles is second. I think as ballots progress, the Miles people are going to move almost as a block to Janicek, and I think that will stimulate a lot. And the second thing, picking up on what Sarah said, is if Cerisi could finish third on the first ballot, I think that would be a huge milestone for Cerisi, and would signify that maybe it's going to be fewer rather than more ballots.
Well, we have sitting next to us now one of the people who's actually going to decide how all this plays out, one of those much coveted, undecided delegates. The candidates love these people.
Maybe that's why we go uncommitted, so we won't be lonely. We'll get phone calls, literature, visits.
Don Jarofsky is with us from New Brighton, and gosh, you've been to every convention since 1976, is that
right?
Yeah,
I've been to every state convention since 1976. I know there are always some people say, why do these people keep coming back over and over? Don't you want new people? And I just say those of us who work on DFL campaigns in between those conventions have kind of helped earn our right to come back again. And, of course, we have to be elected to these positions by local DFLers every time that we come.
So what are you looking to hear from the candidates? If you can fast forward here, do a little time travel here. You're sitting in one of these chairs tomorrow. What's going to sway you?
Well, I think I can't speak for obviously for all uncommitteds because they might be uncommitted for different reasons, but I think most of us are looking for someone who can beat Rod Graham's. Electability is very high on the list because, you know, I've been to candidate forums, DFL candidate forums, I've listened to the candidates. You know, any one of these people is going to be a much better U.S. Senator than Rod Graham's. They all support core Democratic issues. They're all going to be the kind of people we want in Washington. There really aren't any bad candidates, and so then you really do look at electability. But I think the reason some of us are still uncommitted is that they each have strengths and weaknesses. I mean, you take, like, for instance, Jerry Janicek. He might be able to help us bring back the 8th District. If you look at the 1994 race between Grahams and Winia went just about 50-50 even in the 8th District. We should be winning that 70-30. And so if you get that back, that pretty much makes up the whole margin that he won the state by. But then again, you look at somebody like Steve Kelly. I know he's not in the top tier right now, but his argument is he's a suburbanite. You know, the suburban areas are the swing voters. That's where the House and Senate majorities are won and lost, and he's a suburban person who's won in a district that can go either way, succeeded Sally Olson in the House. You know, there are just so many different ways. Look at it. Cerisi is a good debater, smart, effective, has a lot of money, you know. Would probably rip Grahams to shreds in a debate in the general. So, I mean, there's so many. They all have different strengths, and then you have to kind of weigh it. But I think the beauty of the endorsement system is that you can vote on the first ballot for whomever you want, whoever you really like. And then as those ballots go on, as Sarah was talking about, you can make a judgment. You can look at your second choice. We just had that in the 4th District 4 weeks ago today. We had 7 candidates. On the first ballot, they were very close. You were talking about how far the margin is on the first ballot between the first and second person. Betty McCollum was 26%. Mary Rosenthal was 25%. Other candidates were 14, 13, 9, 7, 4. And, you know, you go on about 5 ballots, and we merged into endorsing Betty McCollum because she had a broad base of support. She had a lot of second-choice votes. They may come down tomorrow into who has the most second choices and even third choices in the 7-way field. And, you know, someone who can pull together a broad range in the party the way Betty McCollum did is somebody who has a chance to get endorsed.
Have any of the candidates come up with anything special for you, Don? Maybe a nice bumper sticker that you've never seen before, a button that you've lusted after all these years, anything like that?
Well, it's probably a little more complicated than that. I got Jerry Janicek's videotape in the mail the other day. We watched that. It was pretty entertaining. It showed that he was a good candidate. But they're all doing a pretty good job of sending out good literature, you know, kind of testing the wares to show that they could be a good general election candidate. You know, they've all got pretty good literature. And I think just the fact that they have gone through the process helps all of them, whoever winds up being the DFL candidate, because they're getting practice in honing their messages, in trying to put it into words and trying to put it into something that people can remember and putting it into literature and videotapes and so on. Cerisi, I believe, is the only one who's had radio and TV commercials. Is that
so far?
Right? So far, yeah.
Well, good luck in making your decision.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm looking forward to it. And for most of us who have been in conventions before, we'll stay here as long as it takes to work it out and be successful.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate you coming by. Don Jarofsky from New Brighton, been involved in politics for, many, many years. He's been to every convention since 1976, one of the many, many uncommitted, undecided delegates at this convention, which is kind of a rarity in this day and age.
You know, Don was mentioning the 4th District DFL convention, which happened a month ago today, as he said, and many people are holding that convention up as sort of a model of civility and a model for the way that they hope the convention will go here tomorrow. It's true there were 7 candidates, but very quickly, people that had no chance of gaining the necessary number to become endorsed dropped out, and in the end, the final candidate, although she could have probably pushed it for the one who did not win, but Mary Rosenthal, who came in second, could have pushed the issue for several more ballots, very gracefully bowed out quite early, well before dinner, asked the convention to endorse Betty McCollum by acclamation, and the convention walked out very, very unified in spite of starting the day with 7 very active candidates. So I think there's quite a bit of hope here on this convention floor that this group will be able to follow the example of the 4th District.
DFL conventions shouldn't be civil. Sarah, we ought to end here with bodies strewn about the floor.
That is
blood gushing from open wounds.
That's exactly what those Republicans are hoping for. And so that's exactly what the Democrats are going to try not to do.
I have my faith in the Democratic Party.
Well, just wait and see, Tom.
Not a lot of time left, but if you have a question or comment for Tom Horner, Sarah Stace, give us a call. 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2822. Stan, go ahead, please.
Before I called, I started with pretty much some anger. I'm a Cerisi supporter, and I think he is the best candidate. He's actually the only adult in the race who would be a good senator for Minnesota. But after that, after waiting online for a while, I realized that the main problem is with the Democratic Party. I mean, this is June, and we have 7 candidates. Regardless, 3 are going to go ahead, and then if Therese is not endorsed, there will be 4 people fighting it out till September. And then if, you know, that's probably the second week in September. Whoever wins the primary then would go to fight Mr. Grahams, and that would be probably 8 weeks to November 7th. So I was wondering, and pretty much this question is directed first to the lady who's a Democrat and also to Tom, what is wrong with the Democratic Party? I'm a lifelong Democrat. I'm only 26, and I think I'll stay with the Democratic Party because of what it stands for. But it seems like the people in the party prefer to fight each other. I think Tom was right in his statement that he has trust in the Democratic, especially the one in Minnesota. I've lived in a couple of states, and many times the Republicans are the evil people, and you always prepare to fight them. But I think the DFL loves to kick each other. For the last 6 months, there's been a hatchet job on Mr. Cerisi, you know, and I think to prove his honor, he's not retaliated in any way. I mean, we've heard about how much money has been made by him. This is America. Making money is part of the job.
Okay, well, let's get a comment.
Well, I do agree that it's a real shame that we're going to have so many candidates running in a primary this September, and I would much prefer that the convention would unify behind one candidate and that we would have one candidate to support throughout the summer and into the fall against Rod Grahams. That would be highly preferable from an electoral standpoint. On the other hand, the fact that there are so many people who are seeking DFL endorsement and who are running for elective office signifies a level of political vitality that the party might have otherwise lacked. And I think that it's actually a very good thing that so many people are interested, so many people are willing to put their personal lives aside and to be willing to dedicate themselves to public service. This is a good thing both in the big D Democratic sense from the party standpoint and in a small D Democratic sense as a public citizen. I really applaud people who are willing to seek office this way. I think it's wonderful.
Tom, I was going to say the Republican Party has not been immune from these battles either.
No, certainly hasn't. And I think part of it lies in parties not keeping up with society. I mean, the fact of the matter is both parties represent the extremes of their philosophies. If you went out and surveyed these 1,400 delegates in Rochester this weekend and the delegates at the Republican convention next weekend, I think what you would find are positions on issues that are out of the mainstream to the left and to the right of Minnesota. I do think, though, that it's a particular problem for the DFL. And I think Stan is right. I mean, it's reflected in what has happened throughout the 1990s that, they've lost the last three gubernatorial races. The last two DFL gubernatorial candidates got 28% of the vote. Even the one success story they've had, Paul Wellstone, has been barely able to muster 50% of the vote. I mean, he lost against a candidate who twice ran not a very good campaign. And I think part of the problem for the DFL is that they have been too bound by their history and by people at the top who haven't opened the door to a new generation of candidates. I mean, last year the candidates were, you know, Mike Freeman and Skip Humphrey, who have been around forever. The Senate in Minnesota is exemplified by Roger Moe, who has been around forever. When you look nationally, the Democrats who have succeeded have been the Bill Clintons of the world, who have moved to the middle. And Democrats in Minnesota haven't been able to do that because you haven't been able to get, by and large, a new generation of Democrats to move the party to the middle. I think what ought to be exciting for Democrats this year is that you have a new field of candidates, that you don't have the Skip Humphreys and Mike Freeman's running, that you have candidates like Rebecca Yanish and Steve Kelly and even a Mike Cerisi who can put new ideas on the table. And I think that is going to spell a much better future for the Democratic Party. And frankly, I hope that Republicans take the same cue. I mean, I look at Republicans like Tim Pawlenty, the majority leader in the House of Representatives, and he's a very, very attractive office holder, a very attractive potential candidate. And that's the kind of people that we need to bring into the party as candidates for statewide offices and let them represent the parties.
Well, Tom, that's an absolutely wonderful analysis that can be applied in spades to the Republican Party as well. Talk about right-wing and out of the mainstream. And you know, oh, by the way, did you notice, didn't win last year on a statewide basis either. Norm Coleman was far, far to the right of the average voter. In fact, he actually didn't start his political career that way, but as he moved farther and farther to the right, he became less and less relevant to mainstream voters, and he had to do that in order to achieve the blessing of the Republican Party, and that is precisely why he lost. You'll notice candidates like Judy Dutcher, who are forced out of the Republican Party because the Republican Party will not allow her. And she is a very, very mainstream centrist kind of candidate, actually a very attractive candidate and one that I would suspect has a great future in the DFL party, but she's forced out of the Republican Party because she doesn't pass right-wing litmus tests, and the examples go on and on and on. So it's certainly a problem in the Republican Party. The answer to it is not for people, however, to withdraw and sort of sit on their hands and complain about the irrelevancy of the parties, but for more mainstream people to get involved in both parties. And what we really need to do is to encourage people to turn out to their caucuses, to become delegates, to participate in the party, so that the parties, neither one of the parties, are captives of special interest groups on either the right or the left. I don't think that it's at all fair to just claim that the parties themselves are irrelevant and therefore use that as an excuse not to participate, but it ought to be a compelling reason for people to participate.
Sarah, I don't disagree. I mean, I think both parties clearly have moved to the extremes. And I would concur that I think a solution is for people to get involved. I'd go one step further. I think the involvement has to start around issues, not just around candidates. I mean, I think people have this impression that issues at the Minnesota legislature are decided in back rooms by a lot of moneyed interests and by a handful of people. Fact of the matter is, a handful of calls from committed people, from people who feel passionate about issues, makes a huge difference. I mean, 10 or 12 calls to a legislator around an issue is a landslide, and they pay attention to that. It's going to take people to pick up the phone to say, look, this issue is too far to the left, too far to the right. Here's a position that you ought to adopt. Here's where you're going to find support, and make that call and get involved. And I think as you move public policy, you will move the parties and you will move candidates, and we will have a much healthier system.
So, but I guess the point is that rather than sort of sitting here endlessly debating how far to the right or how far to the left either party has become and how irrelevant they've become, we ought to be talking about how people need to get more involved, just as you suggest, Tom.
Now, I have one last question here before we wrap up. It refers to what I call the log cabin syndrome. Every candidate this year seems to want to prove that they actually grew up, were born in a log cabin somewhere, and were
born in a log cabin built with their own hands.
Yeah. Exactly. Does that play pretty well with the electorate, or at least with the delegates? Or
oh, I don't know. I mean, I think people do want to know who these candidates are and where they came from, and I think it's well and good and very important to know what part of the state or what state they came from, who their parents were, what neighborhood they were raised in, what their values were or are, and where they came from. It does get a little silly as they begin to wrap themselves in a, you know, my log cabin is more log cabin than your log cabin.
Well, and I think if you look at the current membership of the United States Senate, I don't think you would find many log cabins other than second and third vacation homes among the membership there. I think, though, that what people do want is a sense that the candidates can connect to them on the issues. That, I mean, I think one of Rod Graham's strengths, frankly, is that he hasn't had a breadth of issues, but I think people do believe that those issues on which he has staked out a position, he feels very passionate about, and he's committed to them on the basis of principles. And I think it's that kind of thing that really connects with people.
Well, I think Rod Graham wishes that people felt that way. Unfortunately, his negatives are extremely high.
Sure,
his positives are extremely low, and one of his biggest challenges is that people don't know where he is on the issues, and if they do know, they don't agree.
But you could say the same thing about Paul Wellstone, Sarah.
But he's been elected twice, and he's done very, very well. He's got a strong grassroots machine.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. We're out of time. We'll talk with you much more tomorrow.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks.
Minnesota Public Radio political analyst Sarah Stace, DFLer, and Tom Horner, the Republican, joining us during this first day of the DFL State Convention, underway now here in downtown Rochester at the Mayo Civic Center. Tomorrow is endorsement day. We'll be back on the air at 9 o'clock with live coverage. We'll have a special report on all things considered this afternoon, and a reminder, check out our website for continuing coverage from here at the convention, even when we're not on the air, npr.org. Sarah Meyer is the producer of our midday program. Kara Figenshue is our assistant producer. And Randy Johnson, our engineer, back at the studio today.
This week on Dale Connolly Reporting, the Enough Party and live convention coverage not to be believed. Friday night at 11 and Saturday afternoon at 2 on Minnesota Public Radio in the Twin Cities, KNOW 91.1 FM.
We have a cloudy sky, 58 degrees at KNOW-FM, 91.1 Minneapolis and St. Paul. Clearing skies through the afternoon with a high reaching the mid-60s tonight. Clear in the cities with a low 45 to 50. Tomorrow, cloudy with a high temperature near 70. Rain is forecast for Sunday.
From National Public Radio in New York, this is Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Last week, a federal judge ruled that the Department of Agriculture